Good morning, and thank you, Mark, for that introduction. I'd also like to thank the AI Group for the opportunity to come and speak again today. As Mark said, I've had the pleasure of speaking at this forum on at least one previous occasion, and I've always found it valuable to do so. When I spoke last year, the title of my remarks was Changing Relative Prices and the Structure of the Australian Economy. And today I want to revisit this topic of structural change and first talk about some of the changes that are taking place within the economy, and then to discuss some of the implications of these changes for monetary policy. Now, structural change is, of course, something that's not new. It's an ongoing feature of all economies. And over the past century, perhaps the most obvious change has been the growth in the services sector of the economy. You can see this in this chart here. If you go back to the 1960s, a little over 50% of employment was in the services sector. Today, that figure is over 75%. And as you can see, the shares of manufacturing and agriculture have steadily declined over the past 50 or 60 years. Now, these trends have been driven by a range of factors, but I think three stand out. The first is that the demand for services increases more quickly than the demand for goods as average incomes rise. The second is that most services are produced domestically rather than imported. And the third is the rate of labour productivity growth in the production of services is lower than it is in the production of goods. And not surprisingly, these same general influences and trends can be seen in all advanced economies. But beyond these long-term influences, the structure of the Australian economy at the moment is being influenced by two other important but rather unusual factors, and I want to spend a few minutes talking about each of these. The first is obviously the mining boom and the high exchange rate. As you all know, Australia is currently experiencing, on the one hand, a once-in-a-century terms of trade and investment boom, and on the other hand, a very high exchange rate. And these events are, of course, related to one another, and they're really different sides of the same coin. It's worth noting that these developments have not led to unusually large changes in the structure of employment. I think they're unlikely to do so. While employment in the mining sector has increased by around 70,000 people, or 40%, in just 2 years, the mining sector's share of total employment is still low, and the mining boom will not change the fact that the vast bulk of Australians work in the services sector. Instead, due to the capital-intensive nature of mining, it's in the investment figures where the evidence of structural change is clearest. And you can see this in this next chart. Mining investment will reach new highs as a share of GDP over the next few years, and it's likely to account for more than 40% of total investment in Australia. The structural change is also clearly evident in the export figures. Resources now make up around 60% of total exports. Just a decade ago, that number was 35%. Now, this boom in the mining sector and the increase in the terms of trade is having substantial positive spillover effects to a number of areas of the economy, including parts of the services sector. It's delivered very substantial increase in Australia's real national income, and this increase has boosted spending across the economy. But the accompanying high exchange rate is also having contractionary effects on a number of sectors, and the manufacturing sector is clearly one of those. So you can see from this next chart, over the past decade, there's been little growth in manufacturing output, and the level of employment has declined, particularly over the past couple of years. Exports of manufactured goods also remain below the peak they reached in 2008, and this is in contrast to the volume of global trade, which is clearly above that earlier peak. Notwithstanding these trends, manufacturing still has an important role to play in the Australian economy. It employs around 950,000 people and accounts for around 9% of employment, of output. This role of the manufacturing sector is, however, changing. Realistically, Australia cannot hope to be a large-scale producer of relatively standardised, plain vanilla manufactured goods for the world market. But what we can be is a supplier of manufactured goods that build on our comparative advantages, our educated workforce, our ability to design and manufacture specialised equipment, our reputation for high-quality food, our research and development skills, and our expertise in mining-related equipment. Inevitably, though, the high exchange rate means that the manufacturing sector has little choice but to move up the value-added chain in order to compete. This, of course, is a lot easier to say than to do. It means difficult changes for many firms and for the people who work for those firms. It also means ongoing investment in human capital and the latest machinery and equipment, and constant attention to improving productivity. Now, one piece of evidence that things are at least moving in this direction can be seen in the ABS's Business Characteristics Survey, which asks firms a series of questions about innovation. As you can see in this chart, in the survey, the manufacturing sector clearly stands out as one where firms are adjusting, where they're reviewing their business practices. And over recent times, they've been doing this more frequently. No doubt more of this will be required over the years ahead. The changes within the manufacturing sector are also evident in the export figures. While aggregate exports of manufactured goods, a little change from the level in 2007, there's been strong growth in some categories. These include specialised industrial machinery and professional and scientific equipment, as you can see here. And these are both areas where human capital and specialised skills are critical. As you can see on the right-hand panel here, in contrast, exports of motor vehicles and construction materials are well down on their earlier levels. Another area of the economy which is clearly being affected by the high exchange rate is in the tourism sector. As is the case for manufacturing, though, the story isn't uniform across the industry. Indeed, the structural change that is occurring in the economy is taking place not just across industries, but within industries as well. The boost to our real incomes from the mining boom and the terms of trade increase has increased Australians' ability to travel. However, the high dollar has contributed to a decline in travel to traditional domestic holiday destinations, and we're travelling overseas in ever-increasing numbers. And this has created quite difficult conditions for parts of the domestic tourism industry. You can see here on the right-hand side, room occupancy rates along the Queensland coast have fallen over recent years and are at quite low levels. But in contrast, conditions are noticeably stronger in the accommodation sectors in some of the large cities. These are benefiting from the increase in business travel and an apparent shift in preferences by overseas tourists for city-based experiences. In Sydney, for example, you can see here room occupancy rates have increased over recent years and are actually at quite high levels. The second general factor that I'd like to talk about that's been driving changes in the structure of the economy is the adjustment in household borrowing and spending behaviour. And the RBA has spoken at length about this issue over recent years, and we're seeing the flow-on effects in lots of different parts of the economy. Now, one of these is the property market. In the early 2000s, when the property boom was in full swing and investors were busy buying properties to rent, around 1 in 12 dwellings in Australia was changing hands each year. Today, the rate of turnover is around half of that, with only around 1 in 25 dwellings changing hands last year. This lower rate of turnover has contributed to weak employment growth in the real estate sector over the past year or so, and that followed many, many years of strong growth during the property boom. The change in household behaviour is also affecting the financial sector. Financial institutions are having to learn to live with much lower growth in their balance sheets than was the case previously. This is causing a change in business practices, and there's been a slight decline in employment in the banking sector over recent years. Conversely, there's been strong growth in employment in the provision of financial services, financial advice, partly due to the growth of assets into superannuation funds. A third area where the change in household behaviour is having a structural effect is in the retail industry. While I talked earlier about the increase in consumption of services, there are significant shifts going on within the retail industry. And perhaps the most striking of these is the decline in sales at department stores and clothing and footwear retailers, which you can see in this chart here. Since early 2009, the volume of sales in these stores has declined by around 6%. And this stands in contrast to relatively steady growth in the volume of sales at other retail stores. Now, there are a variety of explanations for these divergent trends within the retail industry, but there's no doubt that the greater price transparency brought about by the internet is part of the story here. Many Australians have worked out that the prices charged by domestic retailers for certain goods are higher than those charged by overseas online retailers. Now, whether this price difference is because of higher domestic costs or because foreign manufacturers or wholesalers are selling into the Australian market at high prices, Australian consumers have responded by increasingly going online. And as in the other areas of the economy that I've talked about, this is causing a rethinking of business models, and many retailers are having to make changes to the way they run their businesses. So putting all this together, the overall picture is a pretty complicated one. How one views the economy at the moment depends very much on your perspective. Even within specific industries, experience can vary very widely from firm to firm. To date, though, while there are obviously large effects on individual businesses and on people, these various cross currents have balanced out reasonably well from a macroeconomic perspective. GDP growth is close to trend, inflation is consistent with the target, interest rates are around average, and unemployment is low. Now, these macroeconomic outcomes are much better than those being experienced in any other advanced economies, something that we shouldn't forget. However, these various cross currents are having an unsettling effect on parts of the community, with many people focusing on the costs of structural change. These costs are undoubtedly real, and they are not borne evenly across the country. However, the benefits of structural change are also real, and as we've seen in the past, these benefits do get spread widely across the population. If Australia is to take advantage of the opportunities that lie ahead, the structure of the economy must continue to evolve, and we need to ensure that our labour and capital are used where the returns are highest. I'd now like to... I'd now like to turn to some of the implications of the ongoing structural changes for monetary policy. And there are four closely related observations that I'd like to make. The first is that structural change adds to the difficulty of assessing the balance between supply and demand in the economy. Given the historically unusual nature of the forces affecting the economy at the moment, history provides little guide as to the magnitude of the ultimate net effects of these forces. And this is one reason why the Reserve Bank is devoting considerable resources to understanding these forces, including by frequently talking to businesses at the forefront of structural adjustment. The second observation is that the main role for monetary policy is to keep inflation low and stable. The current list of economic uncertainties is long enough without adding uncertainty about the general level of prices to the list. The task for monetary policy is to ensure stability in the overall economy so that the difficult decisions at the firm and at the industry level are not further complicated by macroeconomic instability. In undertaking this task, the bank needs to understand the forces driving structural change in the economy, and we're working very hard at this. But it's important to recognise that the RBA can do little about these forces. As I said at last year's forum, the emergence of Asia as a major force in the global economy has shifted world relative prices, and the shift in world prices underlies many of the changes that are taking place in our own economy. This shift in world relative prices is not something that monetary policy in Australia can influence. It's been driven by global developments, and it's causing adjustments not just in Australia, but right around the world. Monetary policy in Australia can, however, help in this adjustment process by keeping the overall economy on an even keel. The third observation that I'd like to make is that flexibility of the economy is particularly important when structural change is taking place. To the extent that there are significant impediments to resources moving between industries and or across parts of the country, these impediments are likely to worsen the short-run trade-off between inflation and unemployment. Again, while the degree of flexibility in the economy is determined by factors other than monetary policy, it can have an important bearing on how the overall economy evolves. And the final observation is more directly about the link between monetary policy and the exchange rate. It's been argued in some quarters that Australia's high interest rates by current world standards have put upward pressure on the exchange rate, and this has added to the pressures being experienced in some industries. Some of those who argue this see part of the solution as being a material easing of monetary policy. The difficulty with this argument is that, at least on the evidence to date, something like the current combination of exchange rates and interest rates appears to be what is needed to maintain overall macro stability. The high exchange rate and the high interest rates relative to the rest of the world are both being driven by the fact that Australia is a major beneficiary of the changes in world relative prices that is occurring. They're both playing an important role in preserving overall macro stability, something which has proved very difficult to achieve in previous resources booms, which typically ended in a bout of serious inflation with significant costs to the entire community. Now, of course, it's possible for exchange rates to overshoot. Australia is seen by foreign investors, including central banks and sovereign wealth funds, as a very attractive destination for investment, and we need to be alert to the possibility that portfolio flows could push up the exchange rate too far. While the evidence of the past 30 years is that movements in the exchange rate have been an important stabilising influence for the Australian economy, the unusual nature of the current forces means that we do need to watch things very closely here. An important indicator is likely to be the labour market, with the unemployment rate having been in the 5 to 5.25% range over the past year. If the unemployment rate were to rise persistently, it might suggest that the contractionary effect of the high exchange rate was more than offsetting the expansionary effect of the investment boom in the terms of trade. If this were to turn out to be the case, monetary policy would have the flexibility to respond, provided that the inflation outlook remained benign. So to summarise, the challenge that we Australians face is to make the best of the fundamental changes that are taking place in the global economy. As a country rich in natural resources, we are very well placed to benefit from this change in the global economy. But if we are to take advantage of this opportunity, the structure of the economy must continue to evolve. Labour and capital will need to continue to shift to the resources sector. Industries affected by the high exchange rate will need to find ways of moving up the value-added chain, and parts of the service sector will need to continue their adjustment to the changes in household spending and borrowing behaviour. These adjustments are difficult, but if they are not allowed to occur, as a nation, we will have given up the potential benefits that the changes in the world economy are now making possible. Public policy can help in the adjustment process by promoting flexibility in the economy and by reducing some of the costs of change for individuals and for the communities in which people live. It can also help manage some of the new risks arising from these global developments. Monetary policy can help in this adjustment by keeping inflation under control and maintaining stability in the overall economy. Our judgment is that the current setting of monetary policy is consistent with this, with the board keeping the cash rate unchanged at 4.25% at its meeting yesterday. With that, I'd like to thank you very much for your time this morning, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, Philip. We were talking before about the structural challenges that the country faces and where that will lead us going forward. In terms of projections, I mean, in terms of the makeup of the economy, where do you see the resources sector, say, in 10 years from now, you know, growing, but to what extent? And then what structural influence will that have on the economy? So I'm just asking you really to paint a picture of where you broadly see the economy in about 10 years from now.
Well, we're going to see a very substantial increase in resource exports, particularly as LNG, the LNG investment finally comes to production, and will exports of resources will increase very substantially. In the next couple of years, we're going to see extraordinarily high levels of investment. As I showed in that graph, the investment ratio as a share of GDP will be the highest in 50 years, maybe the highest in 100 years. Now, there's no other country in the world, that, at least developed country, that's anywhere like that. I don't think we're going to sustain that level of investment year after year after year. We've got a particularly large investment going on in LNG, which means the investment ratio is very high. I think the challenge will be, once that investment's put in place and the export revenues start flowing in, what is going to replace it? If you're optimistic about China and you're optimistic about India, which I am optimistic about both of those, I think we can sustain very high levels of investment for a long period of time, although I doubt it'll be as high as it is likely to be over the next couple of years. In terms of the broad structure of the economy, I think we're going to just see more of the same. It often isn't fully recognised just how important the services sector of the economy is. That, as I said, 75% of us work in services. That's not going to change. It'll probably increase a bit further, but That's the nature of a modern economy. And so the broad contours, I think, are going to look similar to as they are now, but we've got an investment boom, and we have to manage that. And as I said, I don't think that's going to continue indefinitely.
Hi, Phil. John Keogh from the Financial Review. You just mentioned China there, and we saw this week the Chinese government announced that it's going to lower its economic growth targets. Should Australians be worried about this, or, in fact, could this be a positive because it might mean that China's growth is perhaps more sustainable and avoid a hard landing there and also here?
Yeah, I was a bit surprised at the reaction in financial markets to the recent Chinese announcements, because I think they're basically good news. Now, what the Chinese authorities are telling us is that they're making a substantial efforts to increase domestic demand. Because the problem in China has been not enough income going to the household sector and then households saving a disproportionately high share of the income that they got. And what we've seen this week is a more explicit recognition on behalf of the Chinese authorities of those issues. I think that's partly... That will lead in time to further policy reforms that increase the share of income going to the household sector and probably reduction in the household saving rate, and that's good. It's a more sustainable growth model than just relying on exports. So I think the recent announcements they've made are actually good long-term, from the long-term perspective, they're positive developments. China, though, won't... It's been a source of substantial growth for the Australian economy. but it will not, and I think it will continue to be like that, but there will be ups and downs. And we have to, as a nation, be prepared for that. We need to keep flexibility in a whole range of policies to deal with those ups and downs. But I think the medium-term central scenario is a good one, but we do need to manage the risks.
Hi, Philip. Katie Walsh, also from the Financial Review. Sorry to dominate the floor. You mentioned that there's a need for our labour and capital to be channelled where the returns are the highest. I was wondering what your view is on the federal government subsidies to industries, particularly the manufacturing industry. Is that stunting or distorting the structural reform that you say has to happen?
I don't want to comment on individual policies. I think the general point here is that because we've got a lot of structural change going on in the economy, labour and capital have to move across sectors and across parts of the country. And if we put impediments to that process, then we're going to, I think, as I said in my remarks, see a deterioration in the short-run trade-off between inflation and unemployment, and we'll all end up worse off as a result of that. So the type of things that the Treasurer was talking about, skills training and making sure that workers have the skills for the new economy, making sure that there aren't impediments for people moving across sectors and country. I think that's incredibly important, making sure the labour market's flexible enough so that it can deal with these structural changes. Because the last thing we really want to happen is people leaving one sector and not being able to be re-employed in the expanding sector, because that will just lead to higher unemployment and potentially pressure on prices as well. So I'm not an expert on what particular policies should be put in place here, but what I do know is that we need to ensure that the flexibility is there, because if we don't, we'll end up in a more difficult place.
Hi. Dr. Lowe, I know you're sick of hearing from the guys from the Fin. I'm from Sky News Business. One of the major banks, as we all know, has made the decision to move independently of the Reserve Bank with its interest rates. Now, I know the Reserve Bank has said before that the banks never really historically have moved lockstep with the RBA anyway. But how concerned are you, or how concerned is the RBA, that this bank, by moving on, say, this particular Friday, is actually going to set a new yardstick, and that if all of the major banks follow them rather than you, because they're their main competitors, that could interfere with monetary policy? Is that something that you're concerned about at all?
Well, the key question for us is whether, if the banks move independently of the Reserve Bank, whether that undermines the transmission mechanism of monetary policy, and I think the answer to that is it does not. It certainly throws some sand in the wheels in the transmission mechanism, but there are a lot of other things that throw sand in the wheels there as well. Ultimately, the decisions that the Reserve Bank Board makes about the level of the cash rate have a fundamental influence on bank lending rates, and that is not going to change. There are certainly other factors that can influence bank lending rates as well, and for time to time they will have a more or less important influence. But at least from our perspective, we're confident that changes in the cash rate remain a very important influence on bank lending rates, and I don't think that's going to change. I think the other point that's worth re-emphasising, one that we've made many times, is that in setting monetary policy, we take account of what is going on with lending rates in the economy. And the current level of the cash rate is at least 100 basis points lower than it would otherwise be if this widening in the margins had not taken place. And we'll continue to do that, to make our decisions based on the level of lending rates in the economy and set the cash rate so that those lending rates are appropriate for the macro economy. And the recent changes in the way that banks set lending rates, I don't think, undermines any of that at all.
So you're still happy with that 100-point
buffer? Happy? I'm not going to say it's whether happy or unhappy about it. It's a fact that the fact that lending margins have risen relative to the cash rate has led to a lower cash rate. And because ultimately, What matters for private sector saving and borrowing decisions are the rates set by the private banks. And so we're setting monetary policy to get a level of interest rates in the economy that we think is appropriate. And we have to take into account a whole range of influences and factors when we're doing that. And one is obviously the lending rate set by the private banks.
Dr. Lowe, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. I'm down here in the corner. You mentioned you're watching the A-dollar closely at these levels, which some might view as a veiled intervention threat. In your view, could intervention be an effective way to take some of the froth off the currency?
Well, as the Governor said at the parliamentary testimony last week, we have not intervened in the currency. We have intervened in the past. Our general strategy here is to only do so when the currency is clearly away from levels that could be justified by fundamentals. At the moment, as I said, the high currency is being driven by the high terms of trade. And the high terms of trade are being driven by these global developments. So I don't think you can make the case that the currency is fundamentally away from where the right level is. That's always an issue that we keep under consideration. It's possible that it could move outside the range that's justified by the terms of trade, but I think on the basis of all the work we've done so far, it would be difficult to make the case that the exchange rate is fundamentally too high at the moment. And the main piece of evidence for that is that the macro outcomes in this country have been good. Despite all the structural change that's going on, growth is close to trend. The unemployment rate is low and has not risen very much, and inflation is close to target. While ever that's the case, I think it's difficult to make a strong argument that the exchange rate is fundamentally misaligned. And while ever that's the case, that makes the hurdle for intervention quite high.
Lise Morgan from ABC Business. The RBA yesterday intimated that issues have very much alleviated in Europe. Do you believe that the events overnight are concerning, and has the RBA been a bit premature in its optimism?
Well, in Europe we're going to continue to see these two steps forward, one step back, and I think what we've seen last night probably is one step back. My observation is over the past 2 years, or maybe it's 3 years now, there's always the hope that a complete resolution will come to a particular problem and we make some progress, but then we have slippage, and I think we've seen again some of that last night. The important thing that we're seeing in Europe is twofold. One is we've seen at the political level a substantial commitment to more medium-term fiscal discipline. And the second is we've seen the ECB come in and now lend to the European banking system almost €1 trillion. I mean, it's an extraordinary amount of money. They've lent it for 3 years at 1%. And the fact that we've seen these changes at the political level delivering stronger medium-term fiscal arrangements and at the monetary level, the ECB, I think has put developments there on a sounder footing, but there's still going to be these setbacks. But I think we're in a better position than we were in late November, early December. There was a real sense that over the summer months here we could have a really bad outcome in Europe, and that hasn't happened for the reasons I just mentioned. But we're going to have these good days and we're bad days, and last night was a bad day. Yep. Last question.
I'm Sophia from Market News International. Is there a difference between easing monetary policy because of material weakening in demand and adjustment in the cash rate because of economic and financial conditions?
Our monetary policy decisions are governed by our medium-term inflation target. So if growth in the world economy were to weaken material and that flowed through into Australian growth as well, then the outlook for inflation would obviously be lower than it currently is, and that, and in that environment, consistent with our framework, we'd be prepared to loosen monetary policy further. But it's really that medium-term framework that's governing our decisions, and we have the scope to lower interest rates if that's needed. And as I said in my remarks, one of the key indicators here is what's going on in the labour market. Despite all this structural change, the unemployment rate's held broadly steady over a year, and we saw earlier this week the number of job ads in the country, at least as measured in the ANZ survey, at the highest level in 3 years. So there's obviously, despite all this change that's going on, there's obviously some strength in the labour market, but that's the part of the economy that we're watching very, very carefully at the moment, because there are these divergent trends, and as I said, it's given the historically unusual nature of the current events, it's hard to be confident how they're going to work out, and I think the labour market is one place that's going to tell us the answer.